I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This month, Democracy Now! Turns 27. Since our very first broadcast in 1996, Democracy Now! Has been committed to fearless, independent journalism. At this critical moment when press freedom is under attack, our reporting is more important than ever. To celebrate our 27th anniversary, please donate today at democracynow.org. We're counting on you. Thank you so much. This is Democracy Now!
It was not like any other earthquake. The roads were destroyed. Our houses were demolished. There were no buildings left. Whole cities were flattened. Everything disappeared. We can feed ourselves here, but no one knows how we're going to live.
As the death toll in Turkey and Syria nears 42,000, continuing to rise, we go to southern Turkey to two cities hit hard by the devastating earthquakes. More than a million people have been left homeless, including many Syrian refugees. Then we look at the spiraling global economic crisis from Pakistan to Sri Lanka to Lebanon, where protesters today attacked six banks, setting some of them on fire.
What are you Lebanese people waiting for to go down and take your rights from this mafia of thieves and criminals that is ruling? Where are the human rights? There's no electricity, no water, nothing at all in this country. Don't they feel us while sitting in their palaces? They don't feel the people. They see us as sheep. We won't stay silent about our life's worth.
Then more on the bomb train in Ohio, where a train derailment turned the community of East Palestine into a toxic disaster zone. The train company, Norfolk Southern, refused to attend last night's first town hall, leaving many questions unanswered. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The combined death toll in Turkey and Syria from last week's massive earthquakes is coming to 42,000. Many more expected to die or have been not counted. Earlier today, rescue workers pulled a 17-year-old girl out of a rubble of collapsed building in the Turkish province of Marash, 248 hours after the earthquake struck. In Syria, relief workers blamed U.S.-led sanctions against the Syrian government for hindering rescue and recovery efforts. This is Mohammed Khalil, a medical worker in Aleppo.
Sanctions on Syria led to a shortage of drugs for some chronic diseases and for cancer and chemotherapy treatments. Due to the disaster, we urge the U.S. and Western countries to lift those sanctions on us. Syria has been plagued with a grave humanitarian disaster for 13 years and is still struggling now.
After headlines, we'll be joined by two guests in Turkey for the latest. A Russian court Wednesday sentenced journalist Maria Ponomarenko to 6 years in a penal colony for spreading false information, unquote, after she accused Russian forces of bombing a theater in Mariupol, Ukraine, last March. Amnesty International's accused Russia of a war crime over the bombing, which killed hundreds of people. Moscow blamed the explosion on Ukrainian nationalists. Addressing the court before her sentencing, Ponomarenko concluded with the defiant words, quote, "No totalitarian regime has ever been as strong as before its collapse," she said. In Buffalo, New York, the white teenager who murdered 10 people in a racially motivated attack in a predominantly black neighborhood last May in a supermarket has been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. There were dramatic scenes in the courtroom Wednesday as family members of the victims confronted the gunman, just 18 years old, when he published a racist manifesto online before using a legally purchased Bushmaster AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle rifle to systematically seek out and murder black people at a supermarket. The killer live streamed the attack on social media. This is Barbara Massey, sister of shooting victim Catherine Massey.
You're going to come to our city and decide you don't like black people. Man, you don't know a damn thing about black people. We're human. We like our kids to go to good schools. We love our kids. We never go in no neighborhoods and take people out. Don't do it.
Was interrupted as a man lunged at the convicted mass murderer. He was restrained by court officers as the gunman was rushed from the courtroom. The Erie County District Attorney later said the man would not be charged for the outburst. This is Simone Crawley, granddaughter of shooting victim Ruth Whitfield, speaking during victim impact statements.
We all know the pure hatred and motivations behind your heinous crime, and we are here to tell you that you failed. We will continue to elevate and be everything that you are not, everything that you hate, and everything that you intended to destroy. We are extremely aware that you are not a lone wolf, but a pawn of a larger organized network of domestic terrorists. And to that network, we say, we as a people are unbreakable.
The mass murderer apologized for what he did and said, I don't want anyone to be inspired by me and what I did. In El Paso, Texas, a shooter killed one person and injured three others Wednesday at a shopping mall. The shooting took place at the Cielo Vista shopping center, which is located across a large parking lot from the Walmart, where 23 people were killed in a 2019 racist shooting massacre. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been 72 mass shootings since the start of 2023, an average of more than one per day. In Chicago, the father of the shooter at last year's July 4th parade was indicted Wednesday, accused of helping his son obtain a firearm license in 2019. 21-year-old Robert Cremo is charged with 117 felonies after the attack, which killed seven people and left 48 others wounded. Meanwhile, hundreds of Michigan State University students in East Lansing rallied at the state capitol Wednesday, held a silent sit-in protest to demand lawmakers enact new gun control laws following Monday's mass shooting, which killed three people, critically wounding five. January 6th, Special Counsel Jack Smith has subpoenaed President Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, to testify and provide documents about Trump's efforts to overturn his defeat in the 2020 election. Meadows was involved in the infamous phone call in which Trump pressured Georgia's Secretary of State to find 11,780 votes after Trump's narrow loss to Biden in Georgia. Meadows also reportedly burned documents in his office fireplace in the White House during the final weeks of the Trump administration. This comes after former Vice President Mike Pence said this week he will invoke the Constitution's speech or debate clause to oppose his subpoena from Special Counsel Jack Smith. Meanwhile, portions of a report by an Atlanta-area special grand jury into Trump's actions to subvert the results of the 2020 election will be released today after a Fulton County judge ordered them be made public. District Attorney Fannie Willis is considering whether to bring criminal charges against Trump and his allies. Grand jurors heard from 75 witnesses, including Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, and his Mark Meadows, Trump's former chief of staff. Willis is also investigating a group of 16 Georgia Republicans who served as fake presidential electors for Donald Trump. In Virginia, Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin has blocked a bill that would ban search warrants to access personal data on menstrual tracking apps. The measure was put forward by Democrats in an effort to prevent private health information from being used in prosecutions related to abortions following the overturning last year of Roe v. Wade. Abortion is currently legal in Virginia until the 27th week of pregnancy, but Youngkin is pushing to enact a 15-week abortion ban and favors prosecuting providers who violate abortion laws. Warning to our audience, our next stories contain graphic footage. The United Nations says 73 people are missing and presumed dead after their inflatable rubber boat deflated off the coast of Libya Tuesday. 11 bodies were recovered along with the tattered remains of their boat. Last year, the UN's International Organization for Migration, the IOM, recorded 1,450 deaths of migrants attempting to cross the Mediterranean. and more than 130 people have died so far this year. In Panama, a bus carrying 66 U.S.-bound migrants plunged off a cliff Wednesday, killing at least 39 people, including children. Some of the victims are believed to be from Ecuador and Cuba. The migrants had traveled through the Darien Gap, a perilous stretch of jungle between Colombia and Panama. In climate news, a team of researchers reports Antarctica's enormous Thwaites Glacier is on the verge of collapse, with warm water seeping under the weakest parts of the glacier and melting it from below. Researchers deployed a robotic submarine to penetrate the vast ice sheet, which is roughly the size of Florida. They found the glacier is susceptible to rapid and irreversible ice loss that could raise global sea levels by more than half a meter. Its collapse could destabilize surrounding glaciers that would raise the Earth's oceans by a further 3 meters, or nearly 10 feet. And World Bank President David Malpass said Wednesday he'll resign his post by the end of June, nearly a year before his 5-year term is set to expire. Malpass was nominated to head the World Bank in 2019 by then-President Donald Trump. He previously served as chief economist at Bear Stearns for the 6 years leading up to the investment bank's collapse at the start of the Great Recession in 2008. Last September, Malpass came under increased pressure from the Biden administration to resign after he fumbled his answer to this question from David Gellis, the New York Times climate reporter.
Vice President Gore was here earlier today, and I don't know if you heard, but he referred to you in his remarks publicly on stage here as a climate denier. Would you clear the air? Do you accept the scientific consensus that the burning of fossil fuels is dangerously warming the planet?
You know, and some I don't know all of the instances that you're talking about. I've been very pleased to have super strong U.S. government support across the board on the initiatives that we've been taking. Some people that are critical, I think, are unfounded. They may not know what the World Bank is doing.
In a statement, the climate justice group Oil Change International said, quote, the World Bank Group still funds more fossil fuels than any other multilateral development bank. Ending this support for oil, gas and coal needs to be priority number one in the next 6 weeks ahead of the bank's spring meetings, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The death toll from last week's massive earthquakes in Turkey and Syria is nearing 42,000 and continuing to rapidly rise. Over 36,000 deaths have been reported in Turkey, nearly 6,000 in Syria. The World Health Organization's described northwestern Syria as the, quote, zone of greatest concern. The area was already facing a humanitarian crisis after nearly 12 years of war. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has described the earthquakes in Turkey as the deadliest natural disaster in a NATO country since the alliance was formed. Survivors in Turkey say they've been left with nothing.
It was not like any other earthquake. The roads were destroyed. Our houses were demolished. There were no buildings left. Whole cities were flattened. Everything disappeared. We can feed ourselves here, but no one knows how we're going to live.
In the Syrian city of Latakia, one mother described being rescued after 5 days.
We were trapped for 5 days. We couldn't move. We were calling God to save us. Me and my son were calling God to save us. Thank God that we survived. But my daughter left us. When I was in the corridor, I told my daughter there is an earthquake. She ran. May her soul rest in peace. Three of us were stuck in the corridor, and then the rocks fell on us. My daughter directly died. May her soul rest in peace. Me and my son are alive. We were trapped. We couldn't move between the ceiling and rubbles. We couldn't move. We didn't have food or water. We wanted water only. It was also dark, rubbles. We called for help a lot. No one heard us.
We're joined now by two guests. Hisha Ulsoy is deputy chair of the People's Democratic Party, a member of Turkish parliament, who is in southern Turkey. It is in Diyarbakir, the largest Kurdish majority city in Turkey, where he has been helping with disaster relief since the earthquakes. And in Gaziantep, Turkey. Osman Makbey is the CEO of Action for Humanity, the parent charity of Syria Relief. His recent piece for Middle East Eye is titled, What Else Should Happen Before the World Takes Syrian Suffering Seriously? We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Othman Makbey, we're going to begin with you. Now, we recognize there's something like a four-second delay as you stand there on site in Gaziantep, which is really ground zero in Turkey. And yet so many Syrian refugees were already there before the earthquake. Can you talk about what's happening there and what you think needs to happen?
Thank you very much. To be honest with you, I have seen in the last few days what I haven't seen in all of my life. I have been working in the humanitarian sector for the last 25 years. And what I have seen is totally devastating, something I haven't seen in all of my life. As you know, the Syrians have been suffering from war and poverty for the last 12 years. And now they are suffering after this earthquake. I have seen people in the last few days without shelter, without food, without any kind of heat. They are in this very cold weather here in the southern part of Turkey and the north part of Syria. The Syrians and the Turkish people here in these areas, they need a lot of help. They need a lot of support. And I don't think the Turkish government can't cope with this huge disaster. So therefore, the international community need to do more. Just to give you example of last year of the humanitarian aid plan, the international humanitarian aid plan, less than 50% of the promises, the pledges, reached the Syrians. Now, we don't need 100%, we need 200%, 300%, because this is another disaster. I met people yesterday who displaced 3-4 times. This is their fourth tent, fourth place that they displaced to. They came from city to city, then northern Syria, and now they came to the south for safety and security. But now they have nothing. So we have obligation, we have duty to support them. The international community needs to do more. It's not enough from the UK government to give only 5 million for this disaster. We are looking for more from the UK government and all other government, especially the United States government. We want more help. This is obligation. This is a duty for all of us to come and help and support. As I said earlier, poverty, war zone, and now earthquake hit the Syrians, and they are in a very dear situation, very difficult situation at this cold weather.
Osman, what help, apart from, of course, you said about the UK, whatever assistance they've given, which you say is inadequate, what other countries in Europe have contributed aid? And has the U.S. Donated anything to assist Syrians impacted by this devastating earthquake?
Look, until now, we haven't seen much. And as you know, because the crossing were affected as well by the earthquake, so Thursday, Friday morning, some of the trucks started going inside Syria, especially from UN agencies. And as far as I know, these trucks related to projects previously agreed with different charities. And one of the charities is our charity, because we received some of these trucks, and that's not related to the earthquake. After that, and after the crossing was fixed, so some trucks and aid started going in. But as I said, if the UK only pledged 5 million, you can understand what about the other countries. And because of that, you can see that Turkey has big share. Yani, in figures, there was a report published by DI in the UK last year shows that Turkey spent on humanitarian aid around 5.5 billion. And this is higher than any other European countries. And this is after the United States, who spent around 10 billion for humanitarian aid. Our friends, the Europeans and the European governments, they need to do more in order to support the Syrians. The Syrians have been suffering from all kinds of disasters in the last 12 years, and we can say enough is enough. This is obligation, and we have to do our best to support them and find solution for this disaster, long-term solution.
Usman, can you explain, you write about this in the piece, what are some of the constraints to getting aid to northwest Syria, which has been so severely impacted? And what are the governments or institutions that are making aid delivery more difficult?
Number one, as you know, the crossing. Because, as you know, in January, the Security Council renewed the crossing of one or two borders to Syria. And the main one is affected heavily by the earthquake. I think the Turkish authorities managed to fix it, by Thursday or Friday. But this crossing is not enough. And I think one of the main problem is one crossing is not enough. So 2 days ago, I think the Security Council allowed another two crossing for humanitarian aid, I think for 3 months, if I'm not mistaken. And so these four are really not enough. And this is one of the main problem. The second one is, you know, the supply chain between Turkey and Syria, because the Syrians inside depend on goods to come from Turkey. And because of the earthquake and the south of Turkey was affected heavily, so was huge need here as well in the south of Turkey. So therefore, there was shortage as well of items and goods to go in. So therefore, because we, as a charity Action for Humanity, we have been working inside Syria for the last 12 years, so we have warehouse, we have a lot of things inside. But what we have finished in the first 2-3 days. After that, the prices have increased dramatically, and the suppliers cannot supply us with more goods. So this means we need more crossing. Now we need more even ways to supply the goods inside Syria. And the third one, funding. So whatever we have raised as a charity from the community until now is not enough. Good, thank God we have other NGOs. Now we have been in discussion with them to support us, and some of them, they already promised some good money. But as I said, all of that is not enough. Governments need to come forward and put more money to support the Syrians in the north of Syria and the Turkish. Bear in mind, because this disaster now affected Turkey as well and the people of Turkey, 23 million of Turkish people, they are affected by this as well. So therefore, we need to support both sides, and we need to put more efforts inside Syria to stop the suffering of the Syrians.
Uthman, you are CEO of Action for Humanity. Our condolences not only for the entire crisis, but for the loss in your own Action for Humanity family of aid workers, which is what all of these groups are dealing with, their own health workers, not to mention doctors and nurses, hospitals collapsing. But I wanted to ask your thoughts on lifting sanctions against Syria. Jane Ferguson writes in The New Yorker, the Assad regime and its ally Russia allegedly are preventing international aid from entering rebel-held areas, though we've heard some aid has gotten through. The lifting of sanctions, and how difficult is it to get aid to the rebel-held areas, and how does that compare to aid in the Syrian government areas in Syria?
Yes,
Yes, there is no doubt that the sanctions must be lifted. And we should have now, especially at this critical time, we should lift the sanctions and allow the humanitarian aid to go in. We have seen from the first and second day trucks going to the regime area, but we haven't seen that at least since the fourth or fifth day. And still, that is not enough for the northwest of Syria. We have to find different ways. Yeah, I'll tell you, for example, the UK government has changed the system of immigration to allow the people of Ukraine to come in, which is great because we have to support the Ukrainians, our neighbors, our friends, and that is another disaster. But at the same time, what they have done to allow Syrians, to give them more flexibility to work hard to lift the sanctions in order to the humanitarian aid to reach the Syrians. So this is sometimes where people feel the double standard. So we need to be, when it comes to humanitarian, it is should be one standard. We deal with everyone on the same scale and the same standard. So therefore, they have all the Western government, and I hope the United States can lead as well on this regard to find long-term solutions for the Syrians, especially those. You know, in the north, in the northwest of Syria, you have 4.8 million Syrians. 4.1 of them depends on aid, depend on charities and the humanitarian agencies to come and to provide them with water, food, shelter, and medicine. This is too much. Enough is enough. We as a charity have been working here for the last 12 years. Even this crisis affected us heavily. And all other humanitarian agencies who have been working here in the south of Turkey and the north of Syria. So we lost four members of our staff and the entire their families. And we lost tens of members of families of all our staff in Turkey and Syria. We have around 500 staff inside Syria, 70 here in the south of Turkey. Every one of them has lost family member or members, colleagues, and friends. And this is for the first time I see in my life that the first group of people who are affected by this crisis are the humanitarian. Therefore, the humanitarians, we need to support them. We need to help them in order to continue their work. And to be honest with you, they still, despite of all the pain, they have still going, doing the work. I have seen in my eyes that their commitment and determination to continue helping others.
Well, Othman Makbey, we want to thank you so much for being with us, CEO of Action for Humanity, speaking to us from Gaziantep, which is also known as Antep in southern Turkey, to Diyarbakir in Turkey, where we're joined by Hisar Osoy, deputy chair of the People's Democratic Party, a member of the Turkish parliament representing Diyarbakir in southern Turkey, the largest Kurdish majority city in Turkey, where he's been helping with disaster relief since the earthquakes. Hisar Osoy, can you describe what's happening where you are? How similar is it to where Othman is, and what you think needs to happen right now?
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity. I am now in Diyarbakir. In Diyarbakir, we have only six buildings that were collapsed, and we have close to 500 people who lost their lives. But a lot of people, of course, they left the city. Many buildings are damaged. So when you compare with other places, of course, I would say it's even not comparable, because the kind of destruction and devastation in places like Adıyaman and Maraş and Hatay and certain districts of Gaziantep, I mean, is really, really big. We are having a complete disaster here. It's a nightmare situation. Not only so many people died, I mean, of probably around 40,000. Now, these are the official records, but we know that there are still tens of thousands of people who are still under the rubble, and most of the rescue operations are already suspended. Millions of people were affected. Complete